Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, historian and author David W. Blight talks with scholar Kedrick Roy about the work and legacy of Frederick Douglass. Blight edited the recently published collection of Douglass's public writings from the Library of America. This edition is the largest single-volume selection of Douglass's writings ever published, including 34 speeches and 67 pieces of journalism. This episode is presented in conjunction with the American Writers Museum's new exhibit, Dark Testament, A Century of Black Writers on Justice, on which Kedrick Roy served as lead curator. The immersive exhibit is now open to the public and is included with admission. The American Writers Museum is open Thursday through Monday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. This conversation originally took place May 15, 2022, at the inaugural American Writers Festival and was recorded live.
Welcome. My name is Allison Sansoni. I'm the program director at the American Writers Museum. And if you've been here since this morning and you've been in this room, you are already very sick of my spiel. This program is presented in connection with the AAWM's upcoming initiative, Dark Testament, A Century of Black Writers on Justice. In the early summer of 2020, as the protests against police brutality and racist violence were taking place across the country, the AWM staged a reading by contemporary writers of the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, the story of his enslavement, escape, and ascent to the halls of power, and his efforts to uplift the marginalized and oppressed people of this country held a terrible relevance to the events of modern times. Douglass's life and work have perhaps no greater champions than the two writers we are welcoming to the stage with this program. David W. Blight is Sterling Professor of History and Director of the Gilder Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition at Yale University. He is the author or editor of a dozen books, including Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. He's worked on Douglass much of his professional life, and he's been awarded the Pulitzer Prize, the Bancroft Prize, the Abraham Lincoln Prize, and appropriately enough, the Frederick Douglass Prize, among many others. He's joined by Kedrick Roy, whose work is at the intersection of African-American history, literature, and political thought from the Revolutionary era to the present. His interdisciplinary scholarship is forthcoming in English literary history, and his public history writing is forthcoming as part of America the Atlas, published by Smithsonian Books and the Bright Press. His public scholarship has additionally been featured by CBS This Morning, the Harvard Gazette, the Public News Service, the Christian Science Monitor, the Chicago Review of Books, and the National Football League. He's also the curator and project lead for Dark Testament at the American Writers Museum. It's an honor to welcome you both.
All right, how's everyone doing?
Good.
All right. I just wanted to make sure this mic was working there, so I appreciate the response. It's my honor and my pleasure to be able to interview Dr. David Blight here about one of our favorite figures in American history. That's Frederick Douglass. And Dr. Blight's compiled a new book with the Library of America on Frederick Douglass, and it brings together 34 of his speeches, 67 pieces of journalism that Douglass wrote, as well as a novella, which was, all this was written between the 1840s and the 1890s. So we want to first talk about Frederick Douglass, the man, so you can understand his life and his history, and then we'll dive into the book proper that Dr. Blight edited. And so I want to ask you, Dr. Blight, who was Frederick Douglass?
Well, first of all, thank you, Kedrick, for doing this. Thanks to the Writers Museum, which I just visited for the first time yesterday. Terrific museum. Congratulations to everyone there and for this festival. Douglass, for those not quite in tune with him, was born a slave, of course, in the Eastern Shore of Maryland in 1818. At a little horseshoe bend in the Tuckahoe River, probably in his grandmother's cabin, although we don't know for sure. He He spent the first 20 years of his life as a slave, 11 of those years on the Eastern Shore, experiencing about every hardship, terrible treatment, humiliation that a country slave could experience. He spends 9 of those 20 years in Baltimore, and that was a great good fortune for him to be sent to Baltimore 2-3 times over, since he has the experience of an urban slave, and there he learns and cultivates his literacy. He gets engaged in at least 4 different churches. He lives and works amidst a free black population, which has a lot to do with shaping him. There were far more free blacks in Baltimore than there were slaves in the 1820s and 1830s. And it's from there that he escapes in 1838. He goes on to be perhaps the greatest orator of the 19th century. There are a few people he might be compared with him. He's an orator first, a craft, an art that he actually had cultivated even while he was a slave. But he becomes a writer soon after his escape and soon after joining the anti-slavery itinerant lecture circuit. But the writing came after the oratory, which is a way to begin to understand him. Language was Douglass's life. Words were his weapons. Words were his coin. He lived, in some ways, with words, by words. Once he enters the abolition movement as this itinerant orator, and then eventually founds his own newspaper, he never made a living from 1841, when he stopped working as a manual laborer, until 1877, when he got his first salaried appointment by the federal government. He never made a dime from 1841 to 1877 except by his voice, his pen, words. Exactly how he became so adept with the English language is still partly a mystery, but partly something we Douglas scholars, which includes Kiedrich now, I must say, have begun to try to explain. He lives the almost the entire trajectory of the 19th century, born in 1818, before all those elements of modernity that would be part of the 19th, before steamboats are on the rivers, before the telegraph, before the rotary press, which would be a big deal in his life, before steamships could cross the Atlantic in 8 days, et cetera, et cetera. But he's going to live all the way to 1895. And of course, in the middle of his life, is the greatest transformation of the United States with the Civil War and with Reconstruction. I guess the last thing I would just say for those not, who have not encountered him, he wrote millions of words, spoke or wrote millions of words in virtually every form possible in those years. And in the middle of his life, is when he's in his 40s, is this Civil War and emancipation that became the pivot of his life, the pivot of his country's life, and the event he lived 30 more years to try to preserve, hold on to, in what could be called a kind of losing fight. Although he, of course, never gave up. So he's a writer, hence we're at a writer's festival. And I've always said, and I wonder if you feel this way, if Douglas, I get asked all the time, what would Douglas think of this, what would Douglas think of that, what would he say about this, and what would he say about that? And of course, the answer is always, we don't know. But if he were to be asked what he was most proud of, I can't prove this, but I think he might actually put a pen in his hand and say that I became a writer, because that wasn't supposed to happen to a former slave. Former slaves were supposed to be people without literature, people without the word. There are many, many kinds of evidence that he was just extraordinarily proud that he could write, that he could write so well, that he could write in so many forms, and that he achieved so many readers. I think there was nothing else he was prouder of than that label of writer.
Thank
and I'm, I say that other places than writers' festivals.
That's fantastic. And I mean, just as you spoke about his facility with words, the idea that he's written millions of words throughout his lifetime, I want to circle back just a little bit to the beginning stages of his life to try to figure out, to try to at least gesture toward how a man can get to this level without any formal training.
Yeah. Well, it is one of the great questions about Douglass. How did this guy, this former slave, become such a master of language? Well, it wasn't just because he was born so gifted. There's always a mystery, I think, of those of you who study writers, and that may be why you're here. There's always a little mystery. How did this, you know, how did Whitman happen? You know, how does Emily Dickinson happen? Et cetera, et cetera. In Douglass's case, though, he does have the good fortune as a small boy. He's only 7, 8 years old when his mistress in Baltimore, his white mistress in Baltimore, teaches him his alphabet and practices with him over and over and over for about a year and a half, 2 years, until her husband forced her to stop. Then he discovers this book called the Columbian Orator when he's about 10 years old among his little white friends in the streets of Baltimore, white boys. And they were all Irish immigrant kids who hadn't discovered their racism yet. They thought Fred was pretty cool. And they shared their book with him. It's called the Columbian Orator. He then went to a bookstore when he's 11 and bought his own. This little piece of money he had, that book was truly pivotal in his life. It was the second best-selling school reader in the United States. It went through 20-some editions over 60 years. It was second only to the McGuffey Reader as a school book. It was a collection of orations from antiquity up through the Enlightenment. It had a certain kind of anti-slavery tone to the whole of it. But the opening of it, it was edited by a man named Caleb Bingham, who was from Connecticut originally, first published it in 1797. The opening of it is about a 20-page introduction that's a manual of oratory. It's a how-to. And Douglass has this book from age 11 on. It's the most precious thing. Well, it's about the only thing he owned as a slave. And that how-to manual has everything in it about oratory. How to gesture with your arms and your shoulders and your neck, and then how to modulate your voice, and you know, from slow to faster and to crescendos. And then it has this whole section that may have come out of Aristotle, although Bingham didn't say, about how the orator must reach the moral heart of his audience. And so, this kid had this book from age 11, and when he escaped from slavery, the only thing he had on his body was this sailor suit that he fashioned, or his friend Anna helped him fashion, a couple dollars in one pocket and his Columbian Order in the other pocket. Now, it's not always easy to claim exactly the influence of a single text on the writer, but my God, did that book have an effect on him. He even used it when he had this, he called them his band of brothers, a group of young slave men and boys that he gathered in one of the places he was held on the Eastern Shore when he was about 17, 18 years old. He'd gather them on Sundays, and he would teach them how to do oratory out of the Columbian Orator. So this kid was practicing language. And I say it in my book several times that I think he's like, in those years, most kids. He finds He finds something he's really good at. And he's good at language. He's good at words. He loves to get up and preach. He's preaching before he ever escapes from slavery. He's even learned how to preach from a text in the homiletic tradition, even before he escapes from slavery. So he found the one thing that he was good at, he just wanted to do it. But then when he escapes and he's in Massachusetts, in New Bedford, and even later, the first thing he does in New Bedford when he's 20 and 21 years old, living as a fugitive slave but free, is he goes and joins the local AME church, African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, and they put him in the pulpit. By the time he's 21, they find out this kid can preach. Take the pulpit, kid, and he does. And that's where he, in effect, gets discovered by a couple Garrisonian followers of William Lloyd Garrison in Massachusetts, a couple of Garrisonian abolitionists. Eventually, he hones his thrill for language, first in oratory, and then within a few years, he starts writing speeches. And as many of you know, and he's only 27 years old when he publishes the first autobiography, The Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, classic short text, taught all over the world now. In some ways, still the greatest of all the slave narratives. He publishes that in 1845. People wondered, how could he have written this? He did. If you ever hear that question asked again, we have good documentary evidence that he wrote that. But right there in that first full-length text, a long-form piece of writing, you begin to see what a writer he is, the way he fashions metaphors. Whether the metaphor is about freedom or metaphor is about pain and humiliation, or good God, there's a Garden of Eden scene in it. He's already using biblical imagery in it. His constant use of adjectives, and I mean, he's really trying out being a writer, and he's already pretty good at it. He'll get even better with time. Although he still used too many adjectives.
No, thank you for providing that historical context. And I really love how you began your answer with reference to this great editor, Caleb Bingham, who's editing the Columbian Orator. And I think that might be a nice bridge that we can use to transition to another great editor of our time by the name of Dr. David Blight. So you've edited a collection of Frederick Douglass's speeches, works of journalism, a novella. What was that process like for you? Douglass, he writes thousands of speeches, millions of words. How did you go about selecting the things that people would be interested in and things that would help folks understand who Douglass was as a person and as a writer?
Well, a great question. I mean, haphazardly at first, to be honest. This is the Library of America series, which I'm sure some of you know. It's a great traditional series about American writers. They have their format, their traditions, their rules. They gave me a page limit, and I really blew it the first time through. I just started selecting speeches, especially speeches. And then the one rule was these were to be his public writings, meaning not the autobiographies and not private letters. Library of America already has an edition of Douglass's autobiographies. So by public writings, it meant editorials, which he wrote hundreds, speeches, essays, in various kinds of magazines, and public letters. He did write some letters that were for public consumption. So I was just going through all the anthologies I had, and I came up with way too many. They put me through a process of cutting and cutting and cutting, and we got down to, what is the number, 34 speeches, you counted them, 64 pieces of journalism. And I was still over the page limit. And then they said, why haven't you included the novella, The Heroic Slave? And I said, because it's 50 pages. and you told me to cut. And they said, well, let's include it. So that's why the book will be 900 pages when it comes out in September. The selection for me was, okay, I wanted to be chronological. I wanted to make sure every historical moment of his career, which is 55 years as a orator writer, every period of his life is represented. I wanted to make sure that the various shifts in his life, you know this well, this is not a man who stays static ideologically. He starts out as a diehard Garrisonian abolitionist, which meant he was always to preach moral suasion. He was to be against politics. He was supposed to be against political parties. He was supposed to be a strict pacifist, et cetera, et cetera. He moves from that ideology. He makes a huge break with William Lloyd Garrison, a really big turning point in his life. In the late 1840s, early 1850s, he comes out sort of in favor of the uses of violence in the 1850s. He becomes a very political abolitionist. The point being, I wanted to make sure that these great shifts in his life are represented, and there are big shifts coming later, too. Turning points in his own ideological outlook, in the kinds of things he would write about. And I wanted the collection to especially illustrate, and I tried to do this with some of the annotation notes, that this was a prose poet. There are certain writings by Douglas. I mean, there's one editorial we included that's only a page and a half. It's the one called Ballot and Bullet, The Ballot or the Bullet. I wanted to make sure that the prose poetry, for which I think Douglas is, I think Douglas's greatest legacy, is fully represented. Now, that's easy to do if you include most of the great speeches. But Douglas was, to some degree, a formalist in his oratory. He had read Caleb Bingham's Introduction to the Columbian Orator. He had listened to and heard and sort of learned at the feet of some other great abolitionist orators like Wendell Phillips and William Lloyd Garrison and others. And I wanted to make sure that those elements of style were all well represented. That's not that hard to do because he does it throughout his life. I was also concerned with making sure that his ubiquitous and deep use of the Bible, and particularly the Old Testament, the Hebrew prophets, is well represented. That's not too difficult because he does it all over the place, but there are certain speeches and certain editorials where he does it best. So I had themes that were very important to me from writing the biography that I wanted to make sure were well illustrated here. But in the end, it's a selection. One other quick thing about the speeches, and you know this from research, it's important to know this was not an orator who just walked into halls like this, and his audiences would be bigger than this. He didn't just walk into halls and blow out the lights with eloquence. He wrote his speeches. Every major Frederick Douglass speech, I guess 34 speeches I have in the volume, every major Douglass speech from the late 1840s, early 1850s on exists in a text. And by the war years and post-war years, in a typescript. So when this guy goes on the road year after year after year, month after month after month, with these speeches, yes, he would break from text at times. He was famous for this. He'd break from text to tell a story, float off into some metaphor out of the book of Isaiah or Jeremiah or whatever. But those speeches existed in a text. He wrote it first. And I think that's important to know about him. Every time Douglas, there's another big turning point in history, whether it's the Fugitive Slave Act or it's, the Dred Scott case or it's coming of the war, God knows, whatever, all the crises that come after the war. Douglas didn't know what he thought, I'm convinced, like a lot of us, until he went to his desk. and he could write it down. He is a writer in that sense, and I just want to keep stressing that. He worked this out on the page, and eventually he then put them into TypeScript. And some of the TypeScripts have lots of corrections, which, you know, scholars would love, you know, annotation notes. So he's not just an orator who preached. He's a writer and an orator, and he combined both of those. In some of the famous speeches, the 4th of July speech, which we may talk about, my goodness, he had that baby all written out. Not only had it written out before he delivered it, 20-some pages, he had it printed in a pamphlet form, ready to take on the road and sell it. He was a marketer. The Self-Made Man speech, he reworked it and reworked it a number of times. It's a long speech. It's a written text first. And I could say this about all of his major speeches. He didn't just show up and, you know. We've all seen speakers like me who walk up with piles of paper, you know, and they just start talking. I remember one time I introduced Jesse Jackson at an event at Amherst College where I was teaching. And, I mean, Jesse owned the room for an hour and a half. It was incredible. But what he had is an envelope. An envelope, a bunch of notes written up and down, sideways, and I thought, that's how he works. Well, Jesse is from the preacher tradition, but Douglas went around with scripts. That's worth knowing. Anyway,
that's good. That's fantastic. No, it's and as you're talking about Frederick Douglass writing down these speeches that he, before he delivers them, it makes me think of Douglass also. As a writer across genres, and there is one genre that kind of sticks out to my mind in looking at your text, and it's this novella that you briefly mentioned earlier that appears in the edited collection.
Right.
And I believe it was published in 1853, The Heroic Slave.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about how that text ends up in this collection of speeches and editorials that Douglass writes?
Yeah, well, it wasn't going to be there in the beginning because I didn't think there was room for it, but they insisted, which I'm glad of. It's Douglass's one significant work of fiction. He sits down in 1853. First of all, the context is he is asked to write something original for a collection called Autographs for Freedom, which is being edited by his own editorial assistant and dear friend, Julia Griffiths, an Englishwoman who had come to America and to Rochester, lived in Rochester, helped him raise money for his newspaper, helped him edit his newspaper, etc. Anyway, she edited this amazing collection of works by abolitionists of all kinds. She got every major abolitionist in the country to write something, a poem, a little essay, or whatever. And she somehow got Douglass to write this novella. The novella is about a real event. It's the story of the former slave named Madison Washington, who led a revolt in 1841, I think, aboard a ship called Creole. In the rebellion, they killed an officer or two. The ship was, I think, being sent from Washington, D.C., in the American domestic slave trade around to New Orleans. Madison Washington led a revolt, and it succeeded. They took the ship into port in Nassau in the Bahamas, which was a British colony at that point. And slavery had been ended in the British Empire, you'll remember, in 1833. So one of the reasons Douglass wrote this is because he loved the irony that these slaves on this ship were set free, as he kept saying, by monarchical Britain, whereas Republican America had enslaved them. But most important, he makes Madison Washington into this heroic figure modeled partly on himself, but not entirely on himself. And it's full of interesting uses of language and the names he gives to characters. The white man in the story who gets converted to abolitionism, by hearing Madison Washington give a speech out in the forest by himself. It's actually a prayer to God. His name is Listwell. Listwell, meaning listen well. That's aimed at the Garrisonian abolitionist, where Douglas is trying to tell them, why don't you listen more and talk less? And on it goes. It was also, as some critics have pointed out, and I think quite accurately, that it was a chance for Douglas to get out of the I pronoun, to get out of, you know, that autobiographical voice. I, me. He was always writing about himself. Now he could still sort of write about himself, but put it into a character. Now, the novella doesn't always hold up. It didn't have great transitions. The plot is a little weird at times. It's got, melodramatic resolution, but that's the 19th century. On the other hand, it is an amazing document in that he is trying fiction, and it's 1853. This is the time of fugitive slave rescues. It's the time American political culture is tearing itself apart over slavery and the expansion of slavery. And he publishes this in this book that Julia Griffiths put together called Autographs for Freedom. Just how widely it was read, I'm not sure we've ever quite figured out. It's had much more attention, I think, in recent decades than it had at the time. But it's a very interesting window into Douglas the writer. And then you have to keep asking, why didn't he try this more often? Why didn't he write more novels? Partly because I think he was just too busy being Douglas, being a traveling orator, trying to make a living, busy publishing his own newspaper, busy getting into trouble, and so on. But would that he had tried the fictional form more. He flirted with it after the war at one point. He actually says he had wanted to write a novel or a novella about his brother, who had his brother in slavery, who had been sold south to Louisiana. And after the Civil War in 1867, by all kinds of intermediaries, found Douglas. And they had this reunion. It was a difficult reunion, because his brother had spent like 30 years in Louisiana, a Louisiana sugar plantation, was illiterate, uneducated, and so on. And their getting together of their families was a very difficult. He says at one point, basically, would that I had time to his name was Perry, to write Perry's story in a novel. And it could have been a great Reconstruction novel, but he didn't write that. We wish he had. There's no manuscript where he had ever started that I know of. Some people have said that in his autobiographies you can find a good deal of fiction too, but that's kind of the nature of autobiography. Yes. But that's we could say more about The Heroic Slave. It's a very interesting read, and it's full of these kind of, it's a little bit like Toni Morrison. He invents names of people that are pretty clear who he's referring to. Anyway.
Yes, no, that's great. That's great. I do want to bring us forward maybe just a few years beyond 1853, when Douglas writes The Heroic Slave, to a speech where it's, not a speech, but an editorial he delivers called The Ballot and the Bullet, which of course makes people in this audience, I imagine, think back to the 1964 speech by Malcolm X, The Ballot or the Bullet. But I'm curious for Douglas, what's the relationship between ballot and bullet?
Keeper alerted me last night that he might ask me about this one, so I went and reread it this morning, and it's an amazing little piece. It's a very short piece, but he published it in October. He published it in October of 1859, note the date, just before John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry. because in the piece you can tell he doesn't know about the raid yet. His newspaper was a monthly, and therefore he would have written that piece in late September, probably. The Ballad of the Bullet. Now, by then, there are two kinds of context for that little piece. And by the way, in the next month's editorial, it's all about Harper's Ferry and John Brown's raid and violence, but there are two kinds of context for that. One is, throughout the 1850s, Douglas has been struggling mightily to come to grips with the possibility that it might take large-scale violence to ever end slavery. He never figured that out. He did not have a prescription for what kind of violence. He did not directly advocate, you know, mass slave insurrection, because he knew that in slave insurrections, most of the people who die are the enslaved people. But he came to argue that violence by slaves, or violence by people on behalf of slaves, was utterly just. And maybe even necessary. You can see this in earlier editorials, a famous one he wrote in 1852, I think. The title is It Right to Kill a Slave Catcher? And it's a rhetorical question setting up the obvious answer. He argues, yes, it is. He says in that piece, the reason slave catchers worry about having their throats cut is because they deserve to have them cut. Now, that's rhetoric, though. That's the rhetoric of violence. But it's all over the place in Douglass's thought, especially after Bleeding Kansas breaks out, especially in the wake of some of the pretty violent rescues of fugitive slaves, some of which he participates in, and then after Dred Scott. If you just look at the meaning of the Dred Scott decision, you can see why black communities fell into despair after that. So that's one context. The other is, he's writing it directly to respond to Garrisonian abolitionists who are still arguing that he said he is literally angry because Garrisonians are still arguing that Congress should be passing laws to stop the spread of and to do this and to do that, and yet they advocate not voting. Because voting was to be complicitous with the political system, which was complicitous with slavery. And he sets it up with this metaphor of the ballot or the bullet. Your choice is going to be a ballot or a bullet, and it might have to be the latter if you don't use the former. It might have to be the latter even if you do use the former. So it's a very different sort of context than Malcolm X in 1964. I don't know if Malcolm X ever read Douglass. I really don't. Although if you read Malcolm X's autobiography, there are a lot of comparisons to Douglass's narrative, although those may be mostly in our minds as readers. But I actually took out a quote from this Ballad of Bullet. This is Douglass in this piece. He's talking about the need for immediate abolition, no halfway measures. He's tired of compromising with politics, although he learns how to do it. He says, for this, the ballot is needed. And if this will not be heard and heeded, then comes the bullet. Now, it was one thing to say that. In 1859, it was another to figure out how indeed do you tell abolitionists, slaves themselves, their allies, to go start using bullets. Well, the very month in which he publishes this is when John Brown raids Harper's Ferry. He did not know when Brown was going to raid Harper's Ferry. He knew that he was. So it's very interesting to read that piece in that moment. He believed that America would eventually, you know, face this through violence, exactly the scale of it, nature of it. He didn't have that figured out any better than anybody else.
I want to transition us to the Civil War. This talk of bullets got me thinking about Frederick Douglass and his great speech that he gives during the Civil War, where he speaks about the mission of war, the mission of the Civil War. So what's... what does Douglass think about the mission of the Civil War? Does he think that black folks in particular should be fighting in the war? How does he feel about this?
Well, first of all, let's understand, Douglass welcomed the Civil War. This is not always the nicest aspect of Frederick Douglass. After Fort Sumter, the firing on Fort Sumter, Douglass became a thump war propagandist. You will not find war propaganda written with more vehemence by, frankly, any American about any of our wars than Douglass in 1861 and 62 and 63. He wanted this war. He had anticipated this war. He didn't know the scale or form it would take, but it was wish fulfillment. For this consummation we have waited, he says, in a May 1861 editorial that's in this book. And now it has come. He wanted sanctioned violence by the United States government conducted against the South and therefore against slavery. It was his fondest, horrible as this war became, it was his fondest dream that somehow the federal government would find itself in a place that it had to organize militarily against the South and therefore against slavery to destroy it. That is exactly what will come about. Did he predict all of this? No. But he is a prophet in the fullest sense of the meaning of that word in the Judeo-Christian tradition. But he doesn't know the outcome from the beginning. But he advocated for all-out war, war on the South, conquest, whatever it took. And I have a whole chapter in the biography on Douglass and war propaganda. His phrasing at times is really quite bloodthirsty. He even invents stories about the evil of slaveholders and the horrors that Confederate soldiers are conducting on battlefields, which he made up. But that's often what war propagandists do. Now, what he wanted is a sanctioned war to destroy slavery, and that's eventually, of course, what occurs. Eventually, he writes many, many speeches during the Civil War. The early year and a half, the first year and a half of the Civil War, he was a ferocious critic of Lincoln because, well, first of all, Douglass didn't have any inside track at that point to the Republican Party. Not yet. He's not an insider in the political universe of the Republican Party. He will be later. But he doesn't know what's going on in the White House. He doesn't know what's going on in Lincoln's head. But he hated the policies of the federal government in the first year and a half, because they were trying to return fugitive slaves to their former masters. They were trying to keep this a limited war. Lincoln was terrified that the border states would secede from the Union and the war would become bigger than they could ever suppress. Lincoln had other agendas. Douglass was a radical abolitionist trying to achieve freedom. After the Emancipation Proclamation, his tune changes markedly. And in my top five of his greatest speeches is the one he gives right after the Emancipation Proclamation. It's called The Proclamation and the Negro Army. It's in that speech that he sits down in the beginning of January 1863 and he writes down what emancipation means. And that becomes the basis of his recruiting speeches all over the North for the next 6 months, recruiting black men into the Union Army. And there's a section in that speech where he says, this proclamation has freed everyone. It frees black people. It frees white people. It frees the Union soldier, the Confederate soldier. It frees the United States from its history. That was Douglass's uncanny ability at times, when there's a big pivot going on in history, to find the phrasing for it, to find its meaning, often in single sentences, which is what prophets do. That's why there aren't very many of them. But the mission of the war is a speech of itself. He writes it in late 1863, at almost exactly the same time that Lincoln does the Gettysburg Address. And he takes it on the road, late 63, and all through the winter and spring of 64, and even into the summer of 64. He even gets letters from people saying, Mr. Douglas, when are you bringing the mission to our town? They've already heard about this speech. They've heard about its meaning. And in that speech, which is about 2 hours long, the central point of it was that now, by 63, 64, the original United States, he argues, is being destroyed. Same argument Lincoln makes in the Gettysburg Address. And it now must be reborn. The mission of the war, he says, is national regeneration. The United States must be remade, redefined, out of the emancipation of the slaves. And it could emancipate all of us. It's a very biblical sort of speech. It draws very much on, again, the Hebrew prophets. It takes the rebirth metaphor to its ultimate extent. He wants a reborn, redefined, remade America. And he fashions it in that, he imagines it in this speech. Doesn't mean it's going to happen, but he imagines it. And I just found those letters that he gets, the idea that they already anticipated in Buffalo or wherever he was going, you know, that you're going to come here and bring us the mission speech, as though they'd already heard about it.
Yes. that's fabulous. I do want to give the audience a chance to ask maybe one, we have time for one audience question. If someone wants to use the microphone.
Yeah, thank you. I admire your work very much. Sort of like, very generally, what's your take on where we're at now and where we're going? I admire you very much as a historian, and I really wonder about what you think about things going on contemporarily. I know that's a tough question to answer.
Well, it has no short answer, but a short answer is I'm terrified. Look, you don't need me to tell you, our democracy is in deep peril. We have structures in our Constitution that if they're not reformed, our democracy cannot last. The Electoral College, the undemocratic Senate, and gerrymandering have to be reformed, or this experiment we're in called the United States cannot endure forever. You don't need me to tell you that after last night, again, in Buffalo, we've been reminded that racism not only didn't go away, as John Roberts in the Supreme Court said in 2014 in Shelby v. Holder, and therefore they could gut the Voting Rights Act, it has found a whole new virulent form through Trumpism and the internet. And what are we treated to now? That an 18-year-old who can buy an automatic rifle and slaughter black people on purpose, and we're just going to take it in stride because we've had so many other examples of it. We're in an existential crisis with the war in Ukraine. The map of Europe, the nature of Europe, the nature of international security is going to be reshaped by this war. We don't exactly know how. Look, how do we go on and on about this? I will say this. This is where reading can calm us. This is why you read. You can go to Frederick, I would venture, you can open any Frederick Douglass speech, read some of his editorials in the crises of the 1850s, and you will find yourself thinking about right now. Think of the problem of disinformation. We hear about it all the time, every day, disinformation, conspiracy theories, of all kinds, whether it's internet or Fox News or other networks. Douglass talked about that all the time. He talked about the, before George Orwell, he talked about the way language was misconstrued and used by pro-slavery advocates to say that dark is light and light is dark and, you know, blue is green and green is blue. He was doing all that. The issue of voting rights, if you're worried about voting rights, go read some Douglass. Actually, he may have overdone it. He believed the right to vote was the most important right of all. He once called it the ring of fire around all other rights. In fact, Douglass even advocated for mandatory voting. He was very open about it. He thought the United States should have mandatory voting and you are fined if you don't vote. Australia does that. He was advocating that in the 1880s. He thought home rule for the District of Columbia should have happened in 1882. That it should have been a state already. Anyway, and if you think, last point about that. We live through now, it seems, constant crises, doesn't it? Everything's a crisis now. It is. Everything's a tragedy now, or so it seems. In Douglass's life, and I'm not saying he has prescriptions for this, but how you endure crises and setbacks and denial. I mean, he got Jim Crowed more times than he could ever count. He had to start processing it through humor, you know, to survive. But how one endures denial, humiliation, defeat, and then keeps at the cause because he knows it's right. That's what his whole life is about. Now, he had his critics, and he still has his critics that, you know, maybe he got out of touch later in life. He probably did in some ways. Maybe he didn't get this issue right, like the Exoduster story or some others. Maybe he was too loyal to the Republican Party, probably was, the original Republican Party, not to be confused with today's. But if you read some Douglass, almost anything, you will find that he's talking about issues that have never gone away. There's a reason why we're always asking, you know, did Reconstruction ever end? Or when did it end? Or how did it end? It didn't end. I know I said last point, but truly a last point. All this fuss we're having over the Constitution now, right now because of the abortion issue. The abortion issue is about women's bodies and privacy, for sure. But it's also all about states' rights. That's what Alito argues in that opinion. Alito is saying, give all the power back to the states. Go read some Douglass. Douglass hated states' rights. He knew that black people would have had no rights, no freedom, and no rights had it not been for the federal use of power. The great danger in the overturning of Roe is the overturning of the right to abortion, but it's much bigger than that. It's the return of all of these things to state legislatures, which is pre-1970, pre-1960. I'm not sure which century that these conservative justices want to put us back in. It may not even be the 20th. Actually, Clarence Thomas is the biggest states' rightist of all on the Supreme Court. His portfolio on states' rights comes right out of Jefferson Davis. So all this debate we have constantly and will forever over federalism, what powers should be in the federal government, what powers in the states, Douglass is fighting and arguing over that issue throughout his life. And all it does is teach us that history's never over. And every time you think you win something, this is what Douglass had to learn. Every time he got something called a victory, he would warn. In fact, one of his great warnings was at the last meeting of the American Anti-Slavery Society in 1869 in New York City. This grand organization was about to disband. They'd won. The 15th Amendment, the Voting Rights Amendment had just passed. They gathered in New York for a final time. Douglass, as always, was on the speaking agenda, and he got up and said, don't disband. You can't stop. And he said, the reason is slavery didn't die honestly. It died only in great violence. He said it didn't die honestly because Americans got up one day and had a referendum and voted it out. And think about our history. How many times have great changes come because, oh, we just voted for it? And how many times have they come because of movements, collisions in history, events that force action? How many slaughters will it take with automatic weapons? We don't know. B. before anything will change about what happened in Buffalo. We don't seem to be able to vote out. Oh, you shouldn't ask that. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Dr. Blythe, thank you.
I want to thank you both for that incredible program and for your very wise words. I want to thank everyone who joined us today. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, Kelly Lytle Hernandez discusses her book Bad Mexicans, Race, Empire, and Revolution in the Borderlands with Michael Zapata. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.